was all done in rather retro pastel shades. But I wasn't about to complain. We could never have afforded a florist of our choice. I wonder what it must be like to have the money to do exactly what you want. The other guests are a very well-dressed, well-heeled bunch. When I looked around at the rest of the congregation in the chapel, I realised no one else here is wearing a fascinator. Maybe they're not the thing, in circles like this. Every other woman seems to be in an expensive-looking hat, the sort that probably comes in its own specially made box. I feel like I did on the day at school when we hadn't realised it was Home Clothes Day, and both Alice and I wore our uniforms. I remember sitting in assembly and wishing I could spontaneously combust to avoid spending the day feeling everyone's eyes on me. We're given crushed, dried rose petals to throw as Will and Jules step out of the chapel, but the breeze is stiff enough that they're whipped quickly away. I don't see a single petal land on the newlyweds. Instead, they're carried off in a big cloud, up and out towards the sea. Charlie's always telling me I'm too superstitious, but I wouldn't like that, if I were Jules. The bridal party are taken off for photographs, while everyone else pours away to the outside of the marquee where there's a bar set up. I need some Dutch courage, I decide. I pick my way across the grass towards it, my heels sinking in with every couple of steps. A couple of barmen are taking orders, sloshing cocktail shakers. I ask for a gin and tonic, which comes with a big sprig of rosemary in it. I chat to the barmen for a bit, because they seem like the friendliest faces in this crowd. They're a couple of young local guys, home for the summer from university, Owen and Sean. We normally work in the big hotel on the mainland, Sean tells me. Used to belong to the Guinness family. Big castle on a loch. That's where people usually want to get married. Never heard of a wedding here, other than in the old days. You know this place is meant to be haunted. Yeah, Owen leans across, dropping his voice. My gran tells some pretty dark tales about this place. The bodies in the turf, Sean says. No one knows for sure how they died, but they think they were hacked to pieces by the Vikings. They're not buried in hallowed ground, so there's all this talk about them being unquiet souls. I know they're probably just pulling my leg, but I feel a prickle of disquiet all the same. And the rumours are that's why the latest folk all left this place in the end, Owen says. Because the voices from the bog got too loud for them. He grins at Sean, then at me. I'm not looking forward to being here after dark tonight, I tell you. It's the island of ghosts. Excuse me, a man in aviators and a tweed jacket behind me says, crossly. This all sounds very bloody interesting, but would you mind making me an old-fashioned? I take that as my cue to leave them to their work. I decide to sneak a peek inside the marquee, via the entranceway lit by flaming torches. Inside there's a delicious floral scent from lots of expensive-looking candles, and yet, I'm not proud to be pleased by this. There's definitely a whiff of damp canvas underneath. I suppose at the end of the day it's still a big tent. But what a tent. Tents plural, actually. In a smaller one at one end there's a laminate dance floor with a stage set up for a band, and at the other end is a tent containing another bar. Jesus, why have one bar at your wedding when you can have two? In the main tent, white-shirted waiters are moving with the grace of ballet dancers, straightening forks and polishing glasses. In the middle of everything, on a silver stand, sits a huge cake. It's so beautiful that it makes me sad to think that later Jules and will take a knife to it. I can't begin to guess how much a cake like that costs, probably as much as our entire wedding. I step outside the marquee again and shiver as a gust catches me. The wind's definitely picking up. Out to sea there are white horses on the caps of the waves now. I look at the crowd. Everyone I know at this wedding is in the bridal party. If I don't pluck up my courage, I'll be standing here on my own until Charlie returns, and as soon as he's finished with the photos, I suppose he'll be straight into the MC duties. So I take a big swig of my gin and tonic and launch myself into a nearby group. They're friendly enough on the surface, but I can tell they're a group of friends catching up, and I don't belong. I stand there and sip my drink, trying not to poke myself in the eye with the rosemary. I wonder how everyone else with a gin and tonic is managing it without injuring themselves. Maybe that's a thing you get taught at private school, how to drink cocktails with unwieldy garnishes. Because everyone here, without a shadow of a doubt, went to private school. Do you know what the hashtag is? One woman asks. You know, for the wedding. I checked the invitation, but I couldn't see it. I'm not sure there is one, her friend replies. Anyway, the signal here is so awful you wouldn't be able to upload anything while you're on the island. Maybe that's why they chose this place for the wedding, the first says, knowingly. You know, because of Will's profile. It's very mysterious, the other woman says. I have to admit I'd have expected Italy. The lakes, perhaps. That seems to be a trend, doesn't it? But then Jules is a trendsetter, a third woman chips in. Perhaps this is the new thing. A great gust of wind nearly sends her hat flying and she clamps it down with a firm hand. Weddings on godforsaken islands in the middle of nowhere. It's rather romantic, isn't it? All wilderness and ruined glory. Makes you think of that Irish poet, Keats. Yeats, darling. The women have the deep, real tans of summer holidays on Greek islands. I know this because they start talking about them next, comparing the benefits of Hydra over Crete. God, one of them says now, why would anyone fly economy with kids? I mean, talk about starting the holiday on a bad note. I wonder what they'd say if I chipped in and started debating the benefits of one new forest campsite versus another. Personally, I think it's all about which has the best chemical loos, I could say, in the same tone in which they're comparing which waterfront restaurant has the best views. I'll have to save that one up to tell Charlie later. Though, as proven last night, Charlie always gets a bit funny around posh people, a little unsure of himself and defensive. The guy on my right turns to me, an overgrown schoolboy, one of those very round, pink and white faces at odds with a receding hairline. So, he says, Hannah, is it? Bride or groom? I'm so relieved that someone's actually deigned to talk to me I could kiss him. Bride. I'm groom. Went to school with the bastard. He sticks out his hand. I shake it. I feel like I've walked into his office for an interview. And you know Julia Howe? Oh, I say. I'm married to Charlie. He's Jules's mate. He's one of the ushers. And where's that accent from, then? Manchester. Well, the outskirts. Though I always feel like I've lost a lot of it, having lived down south for so long. Support United, do you? You know, I went up for a corporate thing a few years ago. Okay match. Southampton, I think it was. 2-1, 1-0. Not a draw anyway, which would have been fucking boring. Dreadful food, though. Fucking inedible. Oh, I say. Well, my dad supports, but he's turned away, bored already, and is in conversation with the guy next to him. So I introduce myself to an older couple, mainly because they don't seem to be in conversation with anyone else. I'm the groom's father, the man says. This strikes me as an odd way to phrase it. Why not just say, I'm Will's dad? He indicates the woman next to him with one long-fingered hand. And this is my wife. Hello, she says, and looks at her feet. You must be very proud, I say. Proud? He frowns at me, inquiringly. He's tall, with no stoop, so I find myself having to crane my neck slightly to look up at him. And maybe it's the long, hooked shape of it, but I feel that he is looking down his nose at me. I'm aware of a slight tightness in my stomach, which most reminds me of being told off by a teacher at school. Well, yes, I say, flustered. I didn't think I'd have to explain myself. Mainly because of the wedding, I suppose, but also because of Survive the Night. He seems to be considering this. But it's not a profession, is it? Well, I suppose not in the traditional sense. He wasn't always the best student. Got himself into a few scrapes, you know. But he's a bright enough boy, all told. He managed to get into a fairly good university. Could have gone into politics or law. Perhaps not of the first rank in those, but respectable. Jesus Christ. I've remembered that Will's dad is a headmaster. Right now it sounds as though he could be talking about any random boy, not his own son. I'd never have thought I'd feel pity for Will, who seems to have everything going for him, but right now I think I do.
Do you have children? He asks me. Any sons?
Yes, Ben, he's...
You could do worse than to think of Trevelyan's. I know our methods may be considered a little severe by some, but they have made great men out of some unpromising raw materials.
The idea of handing Ben into the clutches of this profoundly cold man fills me with horror. I want to tell him that even could I afford it, and even if Ben was anywhere near senior school age, there'd be no way I'd send my son to a place run by him. But I smile politely and excuse myself. If Will's parents are here, the bridal party must have returned from having their photos taken. And if so, why hasn't Charlie come to find me? I search the crowd, finally spotting him in a big group with the rest of the ushers and several other men. I feel a little dart of anger and move towards him as quickly as my heels will let me. Charlie, I say, trying not to sound hectoring. God, it feels like you've been gone hours. I had the weirdest conversation. Hey, Han, he says a bit absently. By the slight squint he gives me, and perhaps some other subtle change in his features, I'm certain he's already had a bit to drink. There's a full glass of champagne in one of his hands, but I don't think it's his first. I remind myself that he's always in control, that he knows what his limit is. He's a grown-up. Oh, he says. By the way, you can probably take that thing off your head now. He means the fascinator. I feel my cheeks grow hot as I lift it off. Is he ashamed of me? One of the men Charlie has been talking to walks over and claps Charlie on the shoulder. This your old lady, Charlie? Yeah, Charlie says. Rory, this is my wife, Hannah. Hannah, this is Rory. He was on the stag.
Lovely to meet you, Hannah,
Rory says with a flash of teeth. So much charm, all these public school boys. I think of the ushers outside the chapel. Can I offer you a programme? Would you like some dried rose petals? Butter wouldn't melt. But I saw how they got last night. I wouldn't trust any of them further than I could throw them.
Hannah, Rory says, I think I should apologise for the state we sent your boy back in after the stag do, but it was all fun and games, wasn't it, Charlie, mate? Last one in and all that?
I don't know what that means exactly. I'm watching Charlie, and I see it as it happens, the transformation of my husband's face, the tightening of the features, lips disappearing into a taut line until he wears the very same expression he did when I collected him from the airport after that weekend. What on earth did you all get up to? I ask Rory, keeping my tone playful. Charlie definitely won't tell me. Rory seems relieved.
Good man, he says, clapping Charlie on the shoulder again. What happens on the stag stays on the stag and all that.
He winks at me.
All good fun, anyhow. Boys will be boys.
Charlie, I ask, as Rory peels away and we have a moment alone together. Have you been drinking? Only a sip, he says. I don't think he's slurring. You know, to lubricate things. Charlie.
Han, he says firmly. A couple of glasses aren't going to derail me.
And I think of him emerging from Stansted Airport, looking hollow-eyed and shell-shocked. What happened on the stag do? What was he talking about?
Oh, God. Charlie runs a hand through his hair, screws up his face.
I don't know why it got to me so much. It's... Well, it's because I'm not one of them, I suppose. But it was pretty horrible at the same time. Charlie, I say, feeling disquiet curl through my stomach. What did they do? And then my husband turns to me and hisses, between his teeth, that nasty little trace of something, someone, else, creeping into his words.
I don't want to fucking talk about it, Hannah.
There it is. Oh, God. Charlie has been drinking.
Jono, the best man. I down my glass of champagne and take another off a passing waitress. I'll drink this one quickly too. Then maybe I'll feel more, I don't know, myself. This morning, seeing all of this, seeing everything Will has, well, it's made me feel a little shitty. I'm not proud of that. I feel bad about it, of course I do. Will's my best mate. I'd like to just be happy for him. But it's dredged it all up, being with the boys again. It's like none of it affected him, none of it held him back. Whereas I've always felt, I don't know, like I don't deserve to be happy. There are so many familiar faces in the crowd outside the chapel. Blokes from the Stag and others who didn't go but who were at school with us. No plus one, Jono, they ask me, and gonna be putting the moves on some lucky lady tonight then? Maybe, I say. Maybe. There's a bit of betting about who I'm going to try to crack on with. Then they're off talking about their jobs, their houses, share options and portfolios. Some story about the latest politician who's made an arse of himself or herself. Not much I can add to this conversation as I can't catch the name. And even if I could, I probably wouldn't know it. I stand here feeling stupid, feeling like I don't belong. I never really have. They all have high-powered jobs now, this lot, even the ones that I don't remember as being all that bright. And they all look pretty different to how they did at school. Not surprising, considering it's not all that far off 20 years ago. But it doesn't feel that way. Not to me. Not right now, standing here, in this place. Looking at each face, it doesn't matter how much time has passed, or that there are bald spots where there was once hair, or dark where there was once blonde, or contacts now instead of glasses. I can place them all. See, even now, even though I've been such a fucking disappointment, my folks have still got the school photo in pride of place on the mantelpiece in our living room. I've never seen it with a speck of dust on it. They're so proud of that photo. Look at our boy at his big posh school. One of them. The whole school out on the pitches in front of the main building, with the cliffs on the other side. All of us perched on one of those metal stands, looking good as gold, with our hair brushed into side partings by matron and big, stupid grins. Smile for the cameras, boys! I'm grinning at them all now, like I did in that photo. I wonder if they're secretly all looking at me and thinking the same old thoughts. Jono, the waster, the fuck-up. Always good for a laugh, not much more. Turned out exactly how they thought. Well, that's where I'll prove them wrong, because I've got the whiskey business to talk about, haven't I? Jono, mate, can't believe how long it's been. Greg Hastings, third row, second from the left. Had a hot mum, whose looks he definitely didn't inherit. Ha! Trust you, Jono, to forget your bloody suit! Miles Locke, fifth row, somewhere in the middle. Bit of a genius, but not too much of a geek about it, so he got by.
Didn't forget the rings, at least. Wish you had done. That would have been the ultimate.
Jeremy Swift, up in the far right-hand corner. Swallowed a 50-pence piece in a dare and had to go to hospital.
Jono! Big fella! You know, I have to tell you, I'm still recovering from the Stag. You did a number on me. Christ, and that poor bloke. We really did a number on him. He's here, isn't he?
Curtis Lowe, fourth row, fifth from the right. Nearly played tennis professionally, but ended up an accountant. See? They call me thick, but I've got a pretty good memory when it comes down to it. There's one face in that photo I can't ever bring myself to look at. Bottom row, with the smallest kids, out to the right. Loner, the little kid who worshipped Will, would do anything to please him. Anything we asked. He'd steal extra rolls and butter from the kitchens for us, brush the mud off our rugby boots, clean our dorm. All stuff we didn't actually need or could have done ourselves, but it was fun, in a way, to think up things for him to do. We'd find ourselves asking for more and more stupid things. One time we told him to climb up onto the school roof and hoot like an owl, and he did it. Another time we got him to set off all the fire alarms. It was hard not to keep pushing, to see how far he would go. Sometimes we'd go through his stuff, eat the sweets his mum had sent him, or pretend to get off from the photo of his hot older sister on the beach. Or we'd find the letters he'd written to send home and read them aloud in a whiny voice. I miss you all so much. And sometimes we'd even knock him about a bit. If he hadn't cleaned our rugby boots well enough, say, or what we said wasn't clean enough, because he always did a pretty good job. I get him to stand there while I hit him on his arse with the studded side of the boot as an incentive, seeing what we could get away with. And he'd have let us get away with anything. I grab another glass of champagne, down it. This one hits home, finally. I feel myself float a little higher. I move into the big group of old Trevelyans. I want to tell them all about the whiskey business, just for the next half an hour or so, just so they might finally realise I'm as good as any of them. But the conversation has moved on, and I can't think of a way to get it back. Someone taps me on the shoulder, hard. I turn round and I'm face to face with him. Mr. Slater, Will's dad, but first and foremost, always, headmaster of Trevelyans.
Jonathan Briggs, he says. You haven't changed one bit.
He doesn't mean this is a compliment. Shit, I've been hoping to give him a wide berth. The sight of him has the same effect on me it always did. Would have thought now, my being an adult, it might be different. But I'm as shit scared of him as ever. Funny, considering he was the one that once saved my bacon, really. Hello, sir, I say. My tongue feels like it's stuck in my throat. I mean, Mr. Slater. I think he'd prefer it if I called him sir. I glance over my shoulder. The group I was in before has closed up, so we're stuck on the outside of it now. Just him and I, no escape. He's looking me up and down.
I see you're dressed in the same unusual way. That blazer you had at Trevelyan's, too large at the beginning and far too small at the end.
Yeah, because my folks can only afford the one.
And I see you're still hanging around my son, he says.
He never liked me. But then I can't imagine him liking anyone much, not even his own child. Yeah, I say. We're best mates.
Oh, is that what you are? I was always rather under the impression you simply did his dirty work for him. Like when you broke into my office to steal those GCSE papers.
For a moment, everything around me goes still and quiet. I'm so surprised I can't even get a word out.
Oh, yes, Mr. Slater continues, unfazed by my silence. I know. You think that simply because it wasn't reported, you'd got away with it. It would have been a disgrace on the school, on my name, if it had got out.
No, I say. I don't know what you're talking about. But what I think is, you don't know the half of it. Or maybe you do, and you've got an even better poker face than I realised. I manage to get away after this. I go and search for more drink, something stronger. There's a bar they've set up near the marquee. They can't pour the stuff fast enough. People are asking for 2, 3 drinks, pretending they're for friends and plus ones, when really I can see them necking them as they walk away. It's going to get loose this evening, especially with the gear Peter Ramsey's brought. When I pick up my whiskey, the stuff I brought, I notice that my hand is trembling. Then I see this bloke I recognise across the crowd of people. He looks at me, frowning. But he's not from Trevelyans. He's about 50 anyway, way too old to be in that photo. And it annoys me at first because I can't work out where I knew him from. He has a too fashionable hipster haircut, even though he's grey and going a bit bald and wears a suit with trainers. He looks like he stepped out of some wanky Soho office and isn't quite sure how he ended up here in the middle of nowhere on some random island. For a few minutes, genuinely, I haven't got a single clue where I could have met someone like him. Then I think we both work it out at the same time. Shit, it's the producer of Survive the Night. Something French and fancy sounding. Piers, that's it. He walks towards me. Jono, he says. It's good to see you. I'm kind of flattered that he remembers my name, that he recognises my face. Then I remember that he hadn't liked my face enough to put me on his TV show, so I dial down my enthusiasm. Piers, I say, sticking out a hand. I have no fucking idea why he wants to come and speak to me. We only met the once, when I came to do the screen test with Will. Surely it would be less embarrassing if we just raised the glass to each other over everyone's heads and left it at that? Long time no see, Jono, he says, rocking back and forth on his heels. I hardly recognised you, with all that hair. He's being polite. My hair's not that much longer. But I probably look about 15 years older than the last time we met. It's all the drinking, I guess. And what have you been up to? He asks. I know there must have been something very worthwhile keeping you busy. I feel like there's something strange about how he put that, but I gloss over it. Well, I puff myself up. I've been making whiskey piers. I try hard to do the big spiel, but to be honest, I can't stop thinking about the way this bloke rejected me with a few lines in an email. Not quite the right fit for the show. People don't realise this about me, you see. They see old Jono, the wild one, the crazy one, without much going on backstage. And of course I like them thinking that. I play up to it. But I do feel stuff too. And I am embarrassed by this conversation, just like I was when the production company dropped me. At least I got paid a couple of grand for the concept, I guess. See, the idea for the show was mine. I'm not saying I thought up the whole thing, but I know it was me who planted the seed. A year or so ago, Will and I were sitting in a pub having a drink. It had always been me who suggested we meet up. Will was always too busy, even though he didn't have much of a TV career to speak of in those days, just an agent. But even if he puts me off a couple of times, he never cancels. There's too much of a bond between us for this friendship to die. He knows that too. I must have got pretty drunk because I even brought up the game we used to play at school, Survival. I remember Will giving me this look. I think he was afraid of what I might say next. But I wasn't going to go into any of that. We never do. I'd been watching this show the night before with some adventurer guy and it seemed so soft. So I said, that would have made a much better idea for a TV programme than most of the so-called survival stuff you see, wouldn't it? He had looked at me differently then. What? I asked. Jono, he said, that might be the best idea you've ever come up with. Yeah, but you couldn't actually do it, you know, because of what happened. That was 1 million years ago, he said, and it was an accident, remember? And then, when I didn't respond, remember? I looked at him. Did he really believe that? He was waiting for an answer. Yeah, I said. Yeah, it was. Next thing I knew, he got us both a screen test. And the rest, you could say, was history. For him, anyway. Obviously, they didn't want my ugly mug in the end. I realised that Piers is looking at me a bit funny. I think he's just asked me something. Sorry, I say. What was that? I was saying that it sounds like you've got your work cut out for you. I suppose at least our loss is whiskey's gain. Our loss? But it wasn't their loss. They didn't want me, full stop. I take a big swig of my drink. Piers, I say, you didn't want me on the show. So with the greatest possible respect, what the fuck are you talking about?
Aoife, the wedding planner. On the horizon, the stain of bad weather is already spreading, darkening. The breeze has stiffened. Silk dresses flap in the wind. A couple of hats cartwheel away. Cocktail garnishes are whisked into the air. But over the growing sound of the wind, the voice of the singer rises. Is tusa kiol mukri, mavurnin. Is tusa kiol mukri. You're the music of my heart, my darling. You're the music of my heart. For a moment, it is as though I have forgotten how to breathe. That song. My mother sang it to us when we were little. I force myself to inhale, exhale. Focus, Aoife. You have too much to be getting on with. The guests are already crowding about me with demands. Are there any gluten-free canapés?
Where's the best signal here?
Will you ask the photographer to take some photos of us?
Can you change my seat on the table plan?
I move among them, reassuring, answering their questions, pointing them in the right direction for the lavatories, the cloakroom, the bar. There seem to be so many more than 150 of them. They are everywhere, streaming in and out of the fluttering doors of the marquee, thronging in front of the bar, swarming across the grass, posing for smartphone pictures, kissing and laughing and eating canapés from the army of waiters. I've already corralled several guests away from the bog before they can begin to get in trouble. "Please," I say, heading off another group who are trying to enter the graveyard, clutching their drinks as though they're looking around some fairground attraction. "Some of these stones are very old and very fragile."
"It doesn't look as though anyone's visited them in a while,"
says one of the men in a calm down dear sort of voice as they leave, a little begrudgingly.
"It's a deserted island, isn't it? So I don't think anyone's going to mind."
Evidently, he hasn't spotted my own family's little patch yet, and I'm glad of that. I don't want them milling about among the stones, spilling their drinks and treading upon the hallowed ground in their spike heels and shiny brogues, reading the inscriptions aloud. My own tragedy written there for them all to pore over. I had prepared myself for how strange it would feel having all these people here. It is a necessary evil. This is what I have wanted after all, to bring people to the island again. And yet I hadn't realised quite how much of a trespass it would seem.
Olivia, the bridesmaid. The ceremony went on for hours, or that's how it felt. In my thin dress, I couldn't stop shivering. I held my bouquet so tightly that the thorns of the rose stems bit through the white silk ribbon into my hands. I had to suck the little drops of blood from my palms while no one was watching. Eventually, though, it was over. But after the ceremony, there were photos. My face hurts from trying to smile. My cheeks ache. The photographer kept singling me out, telling me I need to turn that frown upside down, darling. I tried. I know it can't have seemed like a smile on the other side. I know it must have looked like I was baring my teeth, because that's how it felt. I could tell Jules was getting annoyed with me, but I didn't know how to do anything about it. I couldn't remember how to smile properly. Mum put a hand on my shoulder. "Are you all right, Livy?" She could see something was up, I guess. That I'm not all right, not at all. People crowd around, aunts and uncles and cousins I haven't seen for ages.
"Livy," my cousin Beth asks, "you still with that boyfriend? What was his name?"
She's a few years younger than me, 15, and I've always felt like she's kind of looked up to me. I remember telling her all about Callum last year at my aunt's 50th and feeling proud as she hung on my words. "Callum," I say. "No, not anymore."
"And you've finished your first year at Exeter now?" my Aunt Meg asks.
Mum hasn't told her about me leaving then. When I try to nod my head, it feels too heavy for my neck. "Yeah," I say, because it's easier to pretend. "Yeah, it's good." I try to answer all their questions, but it's even more exhausting than the smiling. I want to scream. Inside, I am screaming. I can see some of them looking at me in confusion. I even see them glancing at each other like, "What's up with her?" Concerned looks. I suppose I don't seem like the Olivia they remember. That girl was chatty and outgoing and she laughed a lot. But then I'm not the Olivia I remember. I'm not sure if or how I'll ever get back to her. And I can't act out a role for them. I'm not like Mum. Suddenly I feel like I can't breathe again. Like I can't get the air into my lungs properly. I want to get away from their questions and their kind, concerned faces. I tell them I'm going off to find the loo. They don't seem bothered. Maybe they're relieved. I peel away from the group. I think I hear Mum call my name, but I keep on walking and she doesn't call again. Probably because she's got distracted talking to someone. Mum loves an audience. I go a little faster. I take off my stupid heels, which have already got covered in dirt. I'm not sure where I'm going exactly, other than in the opposite direction to everyone else. On my left are cliffs of black stone, shining wet from the water spray. The land drops away in places, like a big chunk of it has suddenly disappeared into the sea, leaving a jagged line behind. I wonder what it would feel like to have the ground suddenly fall away under me, suddenly disappear, so I'd have no choice but to go down with it. For a moment, I realise I'm standing here almost hoping for it to happen. Below the track I'm following, I see little pockets in between the cliffs and beaches of white sand. The waves are big, white-capped far out. I let the wind blow over me, till my hair feels like it's being ripped from my head, till my eyelids feel like they're trying to turn inside out, the wind pushing at me like it's trying its best to shove me over. There's a sting of salt on my face. The water out there is a bright blue, like the colour of the sea in a photo of a Caribbean island, like the one where my mate Jess went last year with her family and from which she posted about 50,000 photos on Instagram of herself in a bikini, all totally face-tuned, of course, so her legs looked longer and her waist looked smaller and her boobs looked bigger. I suppose that it's all quite beautiful, what I'm looking at, but I can't feel it being beautiful. I can't properly feel any good things anymore, like the taste of food or the sun on my face or a song I like on the radio. Looking out at the sea, all I feel is a dull pain, somewhere under my ribs, like an old injury. I find a way down where it's not so steep, where the ground meets the beach in a slope, not a cliff. I have to fight my way through bushes that are growing on the slope, small and tough and thorny. They snag at my dress as I go past, and then I trip on a root, and I'm falling down the bank, tripping, tumbling forward. I can feel the silk tear. Jules will flip. And then I'm down on my knees. Bam! And my knees are stinging, and all I can think is that the last time I fell like this, I was a kid, at school, maybe 9 years ago. I want to cry like a kid as I stumble down to the beach, because it should hurt, my whole body should hurt, but no tears will come. I haven't been able to make them come for a long time. If I could cry, it might all be better. But I can't. It's like an ability I've lost, like a language I've forgotten. I sit on the wet sand and I can feel it soaking through my dress. My knees are covered with proper playground grazes, pink and raw and gravelly. I open my little beaded bag and carefully take out the razor blade. I lift up the fabric of my dress and press the razor to my skin. Watch the tiny bright red beads of blood come up, slow at first, then faster. Even though I can feel the pain, it doesn't feel like my blood, my leg. So I squeeze the cut, bringing more blood to the surface, waiting to feel like it belongs to me. The blood is bright red, so bright, kind of beautiful. I put a finger to it, and then taste my finger, taste the metal of it. I remember the blood after the procedure, which is what they called it. They said that a little light spotting would be totally normal. But it went on for weeks, it felt like. The dark brown stain appearing in my knickers, like something inside me was rusting away. I remember exactly where I was when I realised I hadn't had my period. I was with my friend Jess at a house party some second years were holding at their place, and she'd been telling me she'd had to raid the cupboards in the bathroom for tampons, as hers had come early. I remember how, when she told me, I felt this odd feeling, like indigestion in my chest, like I couldn't draw a breath, a little like now. I realised I couldn't think of the last time I had to use a tampon, to use anything, and I'd felt strange, kind of bloated and gross and tired. But I thought that was the crap food I ate and feeling shitty over things with Stephen. It had been a while. Some months my periods are really light, so they hardly bother me at all. But they're always there. They're still regular. It was halfway through the new term. I went to the uni doctor and took a pregnancy test with her because I didn't trust myself to do it properly. She told me it was positive. I sat there staring at her like I wasn't going to fall for it, like I was waiting for her to tell me she was joking. I didn't really believe it could be true. And then she started talking about what my options were and did I have anyone I could talk to about it. I couldn't say anything. I remember how I opened my mouth a couple of times and nothing came out, not even air, because again, I could hardly breathe. I felt like I was suffocating. She sat there, looking sympathetic, but of course she couldn't come and give me a hug because of all that legal stuff. And right then, I really, really needed a hug. I got out of there and I was all shaky and weird. I couldn't walk properly. I felt like a car had slammed into me. My body didn't feel like mine. All this time it had been doing this secret, strange thing without me knowing about it. I couldn't even make my fingers work on my phone, but eventually I unlocked it. I WhatsApped him. I saw that he'd read it straight away. I saw the three little dots appear. It told me that he was typing at the top. Then they disappeared. Then they appeared again and he was typing for about a minute. Then nothing again. I called him because clearly he had his phone right there in his hand. He didn't answer. I called him again. It rang out. The third time it went straight to the voicemail message. He declined it. So I left him a voicemail, though I'm not sure he would have been able to work out what I was actually saying. My voice was wobbling so much. Mum took me to the clinic to have it done. She drove all the way from London to Exeter, nearly 4 hours door to door, and waited for me while I had it done, and then drove me home afterwards. "It's the best thing," she told me. "It's the best thing, Livy, darling. I had a baby when I was your age. I didn't think I had any other choice. I was at the beginning of my life, of my career. It ruined everything." I knew Jules would like hearing that one. I had an argument with them once when Jules had screamed at Mum, "You never wanted me. I know I was your biggest mistake." It was the only thing I could have done. But it would have been so much easier if he'd answered, if he'd let me know he understood, felt it too. Just a line. That's all it would have taken. "He's a little bastard," Mum told me, "for leaving you to go through all of this on your own." "Mum," I told her, in case through some freak chance she happened to bump into Callum and go off on a tirade against him. "He doesn't know. I don't want him to know." I don't know why I didn't tell her it wasn't Callum. It's not like Mum's a prude, like she would judge me for the whole thing with Stephen. But I suppose I knew how much worse it would make me feel, reliving it all. Feeling that rejection all over again. I remember everything about that drive back from the clinic. I remember how Mum seemed so different to usual, how I'd never really seen her like that before. I saw how her hands gripped the steering wheel hard enough that skin went white. She kept swearing under her breath. Her driving was even worse than normal. She told me when we got home to go and lie on the sofa, and she brought me biscuits and made me tea and arranged a rug over me, even though it was pretty warm. Then she sat down next to me with her own cup of tea, even though I'm not sure I'd ever seen her drink tea before. She didn't drink it, actually. She just sat there with her hands clenched around her mug as tight as they had been on the steering wheel. "I could kill him," she said again. Her voice didn't even sound like her own. It was low and rough. "He should have been there with you today," she said in that same strange voice. "It's probably a good thing I don't know his full name. The things I would do to him if I did." I stare out into the waves. I think being in the sea will make me feel better. I think it's the only thing that will work all of a sudden. It looks so clean and beautiful and flawless, like being inside it would be like being inside a precious stone. I stand up, brush the sand off my dress. Shit, it's cold in the wind. But actually, it's kind of a good cold. Not like the cold in the chapel. Like it's blowing every other thought out of my head. I leave my shoes in the wet sand. I don't bother stepping out of my dress. I walk into the water and it's 10 degrees cooler than the air. Absolutely freezing, freezing cold. It makes my breath come all fast and I can only take in little gulps of air. I feel the sting of the cut on my leg as the salt gets in it. And I push further into it, so that the water comes up to my chest, then my shoulders, and now I really can't breathe properly, like I'm wearing a corset. I feel tiny fireworks explode in my head and on the surface of my skin, and all the bad thoughts loosen so I can look at them more easily. I put my head under, shaking it to encourage the bad thoughts to float away. A wave comes, and the water fills my mouth. It's so salty it makes me gag, and when I gag, I swallow more water and don't manage to breathe, and more water goes in, and it's in my nose too, and each time I open my mouth for air, more water comes in instead, great big salty gulps of it. I can feel the movement of the water under my feet, and it feels like it's tugging me somewhere, trying to take me with it. It's like my body knows something I don't, because it's fighting for me, my arms and legs thrashing out. I wonder if this is a bit what drowning is like. Then I wonder if I am drowning.
Jules, the bride. Will and I have been away from the melee, having our photos taken beside the cliffs. The wind has definitely picked up. It did so as soon as we stepped outside the protection of the chapel, and the handfuls of thrown confetti were whipped away and out to sea before they could even touch us. Thank goodness I decided to wear my hair down, so the elements can only do so much damage. I feel it rippling out behind me, and the train of my skirt lifts in a stream of silk. The photographer loves this. "You look like an ancient Gaelic queen with that crown, and you're a colouring," he calls. Will grins. "My Gaelic queen," he mouths. I smile back at him. "My husband." When the photographer asks us to kiss, I slip my tongue into his mouth and he responds in kind, until the photographer, somewhat flustered, suggests that these photos might be a little racy for the official records. Now we return to our guests. The faces that turn towards us as we walk among them are already flushed with warmth and booze. In front of them, I feel oddly stripped bare, as though the stress of earlier might be visible on my face. I try to remind myself of the pleasure of friends and loved ones being here together in one place, clearly enjoying themselves, and that it's worked. I have created an event that people will remember, will talk about, will try, and probably fail, to replicate. On the horizon, darker clouds mass ominously. Women clasp their hats to their heads, their skirts to their thighs, with small shrieks of hilarity. I can feel the wind tugging at my outfit too, flinging up the heavy silk skirt of my dress as though it were light as tissue, whistling through the metal spokes of my headpiece as if it would quite like to rip it from my head and hurl it out to sea. I glance across at Will to see if he's noticed. He's surrounded by a gaggle of well-wishers and is being his usual, charming self. But I sense that he's not fully engaged. He keeps glancing distractedly over the shoulders of the various relatives and friends who come up to greet us, as though he's searching for someone or looking at something. "What is it?" I ask. I take his hand. It looks different to me now. Foreign with its plain band of gold. "Is that Pierce over there?" he says, talking to Jono. I follow his gaze. There, indeed, is Pierce Whiteley, producer of Survive the Night, balding head bent earnestly as he listens to whatever Jono has to say. "Yes," I say. "That's him. What's the matter?" Because something is the matter, I'm sure of it. I can see it from Will's frown. It's an expression I rarely see him wear, this look of slightly anxious distraction. "Nothing in particular," he says. "Well, it's just a little awkward, you know, because Jono was turned down for the TV stuff. Not sure who it's more awkward for, to be honest. Perhaps I should go over and rescue one of them." "They're grown men," I say. "I'm sure they can handle themselves." Will hardly seems to have heard me. In fact, he's dropped my hand and is making his way across the grass towards them, pushing politely but decisively past the guests who turn to greet him as he goes. It's very out of character. I look after him, wondering. I'd thought the sense of unease would leave me, after the ceremony, after we'd said those all-important vows. But it's still with me, sitting like sickness in the pit of my stomach. I have the sense that there's something malign stalking me, as though at the very edge of my vision, of which I can never get a proper glimpse. But that's crazy. I just need a moment to myself, I decide, away from the fray. I move quickly past the guests on the outskirts of the crowd. Head down, stride purposeful in case one of them tries to stop me. I enter the folly via the kitchen. It's blissfully quiet inside. I close my eyes for a long moment in relief. On the butcher's block in the centre of the kitchen, something, part of the meal for later, no doubt, is covered with a large cloth. I find a glass, run myself a cold drink of water, listen to the soothing tick of the clock on the wall. I stand there facing the sink, and as I sip my water, I count to 10 and back down again. You're being ridiculous, Jules. It's all in your head. I'm not sure what it is that makes me aware I am not alone. Some animal sense, maybe? I turn, and in the doorway I see... Oh, God. I gasp, stumble backwards, my heart hammering. It's a man holding a huge knife, his front smeared with blood. Jesus Christ, I whisper. I shrink away from him, just managing not to drop my glass. A beat of pure fear, of racing adrenaline. Then logic reasserts itself. It's Freddy, Aoife's husband. He's holding a carving knife, and the blood smears are on the butcher's apron he wears tied about his waist.
Sorry,
he says, in that awkward way of his.
Didn't mean to give you a fright. I'm carving the lamb in here. There's a better surface than in the catering tent.
As if to demonstrate, he lifts the cloth from the butcher's block, and beneath I see all the clustered racks of lamb, the crimson, glistening meat, the upthrust white bones. As my heartbeat returns to normal, I'm humiliated to think how naked the fear must have been on my face. Well, I say, trying to inject a note of authority. I'm sure it will be delicious. Thank you. And I walk quickly, but careful not to hurry, out of the kitchen. As I rejoin my milling guests, I become aware of a change in the energy of the crowd. There's a new hum of interest. It seems that something's going on out to sea. Everyone is beginning to turn and look, caught by whatever's happening. What is it? I ask, craning to see overheads, unable to make out anything at all. The crowd is thinning around me, people drifting away wordlessly towards the sea, trying to get a better view of whatever is going on. Maybe some sea creature? They see dolphins from here regularly, Aoife told me. More rarely, a whale. That would be quite a spectacle. Even a nice bit of atmospheric detail. But the noises coming from those at the front of the crowd of guests don't seem the right pitch for that. I'd expect shrieks and exclamations, excited gesturing. They're watching whatever it is intently, but they're not making very much noise. That makes me uneasy. It suggests it's something bad. I press forward. People have become pushy, clustering for position as though they're vying for the best view at a gig. Before, as the bride, I was like a queen among them, cutting a sway through the crowd wherever I walked. Now they have forgotten themselves, too intent on whatever it is that is going on. Let me through! I shout. I want to see! Finally, they part for me, and I move forward, up to the front. There is something out there. Squinting, eyes shielded against the light, I can make out the dark shape of a head. It could be a seal or some other sea creature, save for the occasional appearance of a white hand. There is someone in the water. It's difficult to get a proper glimpse of him or her from here. It must be one of the guests. It's not like anyone could swim here from the mainland. I wouldn't be surprised if it were Jono, although it can't be. He was chatting to Pierce moments ago. So if it's not him, perhaps it's one of the other exhibitionists in our number. One of the ushers, showing off. But as I look more closely, I realise the swimmer isn't facing the shore, but out to sea. And they aren't swimming, I see now. In fact, they're drowning, a woman is shouting. Hannah, I think. They're caught in the current. Look. I'm moving forward, trying to get a better look, pushing through the watching crowd of guests. And then finally, I'm at the front and I can see more clearly. Or perhaps it's simply that strange, deep knowledge. The way we know those closest to us from a long distance, even if we only see the back of a head. Olivia, I shout. It's Olivia. Oh my God, it's Olivia. I'm trying to run, my skirt catching under my heels and hampering me. I hear the sound of tearing silk and ignore it. Kick off my shoes, keep running, losing my footing as my feet sink into wet, marshy patches of ground. I've never been a runner, and it's a whole other issue in a wedding dress. I seem to be moving unbelievably slowly. Will, thank God, doesn't seem to have the same problem. He tears past me, followed by Charlie and several others. When I finally get to the beach, it takes a few moments for me to work out what's going on, to understand the scene in front of me. Hannah, who must have started running too, arrives next to me, breathing hard. Charlie and Jono stand thigh deep in the water, with several other men behind them on the water's edge. Femi, Duncan, and others. And beyond them, emerging from the depths, is Will, with Olivia in his arms. She seems to be struggling, fighting him, her arms windmilling, her legs kicking out desperately. He holds on tight. Her hair is a black slick. Her dress is absolutely translucent. She looks so pale, her skin tinged with blue. She could have drowned, Jono says, as he returns to the beach. He looks distraught. For the first time, I feel more warmly towards him. Lucky we spotted her. Crazy kid, anyone could see it's not sheltered here. Could have got swept straight out to the open sea. Will gets to shore and lets Olivia go. She launches herself away from him and stands staring at us all. Her eyes are black and impenetrable. You can see her near-naked body through the soaked dress. The dark points of her nipples, the small pit of her navel. She looks primeval, like a wild animal. I see that Will's face and throat are scratched, red marks springing up livid on his skin. And at the sight of these, a switch is flicked. Where a second ago I had been full of fear for her, now I feel a violent, red-hot solar flare of rage. The crazy little bitch, I say. Jules, Hannah says gently, but not so gently that I can't hear the note of opprobrium in her voice. You know, I don't think Olivia's okay. I think she might need help. Oh, for God's sake, Hannah. I spin towards her. Look, I get how kind and maternal you are and whatever, but Olivia doesn't need a fucking mother. She's already got one who gives her a lot more attention, let me tell you, than I ever got. Olivia doesn't need help. She needs to get her fucking act together. I'm not going to have her ruining my wedding, so back off, okay? I see her step, almost stumble backwards. I'm dimly aware of her expression of hurt, of shock. I've gone beyond the pale. There, it's done. But right now, I don't care. I turn back to Olivia. What the hell were you doing? I scream at her. Olivia merely gazes back at me, dully, mute. She looks like she's drunk. I grab hold of her shoulders. Her skin is freezing to the touch. I want to shake her, slap her, pull her hair, demand answers. And then her mouth opens and closes, open and closes. I stare at her, trying to work it out. It is as though she is attempting to form words, but her voice won't come. The expression in her eyes is intent, pleading. It sends a chill through me. For a moment, I feel as though she is trying hard to semaphore a message I don't have the means to decipher. Is it an apology? An explanation? Before I have a chance to ask her to try again, my mother is upon us. Oh, my girls! My girls! She clasps us both to her bony embrace. Beneath the billowing cloud of Shalimar, I smell the sharp, acrid tang of her sweat, her fear. It is Olivia she's really reaching for, of course. But for a moment, I allow myself to yield to her embrace. Then I glance behind me. The other guests are catching up with us. I can hear the murmur of their voices, sense the excitement coming off them. I need to diffuse this whole situation. Anyone else fancy a swim? I call. No one laughs. The silence seems to stretch out. They all seem to be waiting, now the show is over, for some cue as to where to go now, how to behave. I don't know what to do. This is not in my playbook. So I stand, staring back at them, feeling the dampness of the beach soaking into the skirt of my dress. Thank God for Aoife, who appears among them, neat in her sensible navy dress and wedge shoes, absolutely unflustered. I see them turn to her, as though recognising her authority. Everyone, she calls. Listen up. For a small, quiet woman, her voice is impressively resonant. If you'll all follow me back this way, the wedding breakfast will be served soon. The Marquis awaits.
Jono, the best man. Look at him, playing the hero, carrying Jules' sister out of the water. Just fucking look at him. He's always been so good at getting people to see exactly what he wants them to see. I know Will better than other people, maybe better than anyone in the world. I'll bet I know him a lot better than Jules does, or probably ever will. With her, he's put on the mask, put up the screen. But I have kept his secrets for him, because they are both of ours to keep. I always knew he was a ruthless fucker. I've known it since school, when he stole those exam papers. But I thought I was safe from that side of his character. I'm his best friend. That's what I thought until about half an hour ago, anyway. It was such a shame, Piers said, when we heard you didn't want to do it. I mean, Will goes down an absolute storm with the ladies, of course. He's made for TV. But he can be a bit too smooth. And between you and me, I don't think male viewers like him all that much. The consumer research we've done has suggested they find him a bit... Well, I think the expression one participant used was a bit of an arse. Some viewers, the men especially, are turned off by a host who they see as a bit too good-looking. You'd have balanced all that. Hang on, mate, I said. Why did you think I didn't want to do it? Piers looked a bit put out at first. I don't think he's the sort of bloke who likes to be cut off in full flow when he's talking about demographics. Then he frowned, registering what I'd said. Why did we think... He stopped, shook his head. Well, you never turned up at the meeting, that's why. I didn't have a clue what he was talking about. What meeting? The meeting we had to discuss how everything would progress. Will turned up with his agent and said, unfortunately, you and he had had a long discussion and you decided it wasn't for you after all, that you weren't a TV sort of bloke. All the stuff I've been saying to everyone these past 4 years. Except I never said it to Will. Not then, anyway. Not before some sort of important meeting. I never heard of any meeting, I said. I got an email saying you didn't want me. It seemed to take a while for the penny to drop. Then Piers' mouth opened and closed gormlessly, silently like a fish. Bloop, bloop, bloop. Finally he said, that's impossible. Nope, I told him. No, it isn't. And I can tell you that for certain because I never heard about a meeting. But we emailed, yeah. You never had my email, though, did you? It all went through Will and his agent. They sorted everything like that. Well, Pierce said. I think he'd just worked out that he'd open up a massive can of worms. Well, he went on, like he might as well say it all now. He definitely told us that you weren't interested, that you'd had this whole period of soul-searching and told him you decided against it. And it was such a shame because you and Will, as we'd always planned, the rough and the smooth, now that could be TV dynamite. There was no point in saying any more to Piers about it. He already looked like he wished he could teleport to anywhere else. We're on a small island, mate, and Eddie told him, nowhere to go. I wasn't surprised he felt like that, though. I could see him glancing over my shoulder, searching for someone to save him. But my beef wasn't with him. It was with the bloke I thought was my best friend. Speak of the devil, Will had started striding towards us, grinning at us both, looking so fucking handsome with not a hair out of place, despite the wind. What are you two over here gossiping about? He asked. He was close enough that I could see the beads of sweat on his forehead. See, Will is the sort of bloke who hardly ever sweats.